John Doggett-Williams is a journalist, documentary maker, and the producer of The Big Picture, the films of Charles Chauvel, and joins us on the program. Hello, John.
Hi, Trevor.
John, why do you think his story is one that needs to be looked at?
He's so relevant to today, and he made 9 feature films between 1926 and 1955. And I think he made Jeddah, which was the first Australian film to feature 2 Aboriginal tribal people as leads. It's the first Australian film in colour. He also made 40,000 Horsemen, which told the story of the Australian light horse in World War I. He launched the careers of Chips Rafferty in that film. Chips described the charge scene in that film as the greatest in the history of cinema anywhere in the world.
It's almost Cecil B. DeMillian.
Well, that scene in particular, which I had the pleasure of editing, was an amazing sequence. Frank Hurley was one of the 4 cameramen who did that, and Frank Hurley is world-renowned still for his photos of the Shackleton expedition in 1913, I think it was.
We spoke about him on the program not long ago.
He became a great cinematographer working with Chauvel, and that sequence, he got the belly shots of the horses, the hundreds of horses. I think there were 100 horses in the initial charge in Cronulla and 400 on the other charge in Orange. It was an incredible sequence. He also launched the career of Errol Flynn and Peter Finch.
Because we know those names so well, but don't know his name as well. Why is it that his name isn't as well recognised as the names of the people that he launched the
career
on?
If we were Americans with American culture, with the way that they revere their film and keep their culture going, I mean, you see the cult of the Oscars every year. It's a ritual we all attend. And it's pure glitz and glamour and showmanship. And we know all their names. We know the names of all those performers, and Charles Chauvel, especially after the way that I've come to know him through the research over the past few months, is a name that should be revered in Australia, because not only because of the films he made were often flawed because of the limitations of budget and technical constraints that Australia suffered in those days. Film was such a high tech industry and so expensive to make that, you know, they really had to, Australian inventiveness really got a lot of those films over the line. But one thing that is constant and has really endured in Australian film culture is Chauvel's personality, his incredible drive and determination, his refusal to accept no for an answer. If he had a vision for a film, he pursued it. He pursued it to his own cost. Michael Pate, who was another actor that Chauvel encouraged and promoted, said that Charles burnt himself out in the end. He died of a heart attack, sadly, at 62, as he was coming into an absolute peak.
Isn't it interesting, because Australia has got such a strong history in film history that we're not recognised internationally for the role that we've played in film in general. But this is just another example of how we haven't been recognised, because this filmmaker should be recognised internationally as one of the great filmmakers.
Well, I think in some ways he will, but as I said, you know, Australian film, I spent 7 years working with Jan Epstein researching history in Australian film, and we watched 200 Australian films, which I think, you know, we often deserved a medal for putting
There's not many of us
through
that have.
And it's hard work. I mean, we all grew up on the greatest films that you can see. I mean, you know the names of Citizen Kane, Gone with the Wind, much more than you do 40,000 Horsemen or Sons of Matthew. And there's a reason for that, apart from the huge publicity machine, that an incredible level of detail that the American film industry had from its absolute beginnings.
And did he go overseas? Did he go to America?
Oh, yeah. No, there's... I consider Chauvel to be the first career Australian filmmaker. He worked at... accidentally, he found a career path for himself. And he went to Hollywood in 1923, might have been 22, but 1923, and he worked as in a variety of jobs in Hollywood. He was an extra in many films. He grew up in Fassifern. He was born in Warwick in Queensland, and he grew up on a farm, and he was a superb horseman. He had a great love of nature. He had a great understanding and empathy with animals and the bush.
Hmm.
And I think that sensitivity... he actually got work because he was a great horseman working as an extra. You know, some scenes would be a good guy and other scenes would be a bad guy. He worked at the Hal Roach Studios. He worked for a time as a publicist for Douglas Fairbanks while he was making The Thief of Baghdad, which to film buffs, they'll know that film for its special effects. And
Was he making films in Australia at this time and then went there?
No, he was young. He was born in 1897, so in the early 20s, was 25, 26. He followed the great Snowy Baker. Snowy was a legendary figure around that time, you know, post-war. He was a daredevil. You know, Snowy represented Australia at the 1908 Olympics and was reputed to be a champion in 26 sports. And he made films, and he made socially progressive films, Snowy Baker.
Yeah.
And Chevelle came under his wing when he finally escaped from his family farm and made it down to Sydney. And Snowy was a follower of Dale Carnegie, who was a name that's, you know, sort of, I don't think he wrote, I can't remember the name of his famous book, but it was something like Think and Grow Rich,
mm-hmm.
you know, Napoleon Hill's book. And it had a whole philosophy of life, and that you had to know idleness was the work of the devil and you should never be idle. And Chevelle took that on and he worked very hard. In fact, he went to Hollywood because he followed Snowy there. And Snowy was an expert, as I said, a horseman, but he was also known for the Sydney Flash, which was his work with whips.
Okay.
And the Sydney Flash was his ability to whip a cigarette out of someone's mouth from 20 feet. And for 2 months going around Hollywood, Chevelle was his stooge. He was the person with the candle on his head and the cigarette in his mouth and the full circus tent. And he did it for 2 months.
God, we've got characters in Australian history that we just don't know about.
Chevelle's incredible. Like all these young filmmakers that are going out on the streets of Melbourne and around Australia now with this high-tech stuff, they think they're inventing it for the first time. But there's not many who could be a horseman and stand there and take the wind.
Dick wants to join us. Hello, Dick. Are you there, Dick? He's dropped off the line. Good morning, Yvonne.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, Yvonne.
We used to go riding. We lived at Cronulla. We used to go riding at Perth Fielding's Riding School every day in the summer holidays.
Mm-hmm.
And they made 40,000 horsemen in the sandhills between Cronulla and Kurnell.
Yes, I read that.
That's right. Before that, there was only a track for the bus. And at the end of our school holidays, if we were really, really good, we were taken on a picnic out to Kurnell. And we could ride Prince, who was the star horse in 40,000 horses.
Ah, right.
The best rider got to ride Prince.
Right.
We learned to ride a horse and buggy, and we'd take a picnic out to Kurnell and come over again. And it was, and all the horses that we'd ridden were in the movie.
Do you remember the minaret at the Middle Eastern?
I do.
How long did it last?
Oh, it was made out of plaster in Paris and chicken wire.
What was it?
Well, they made a model of El Arish in the middle of the desert, and there was. Forgive me. It was a mock mosque where the faithful would be called to prayer. And basically, they made a scale model of it on the sandhills, and they left it there for decades.
Yeah, but it didn't take long to.
Yeah, right, okay. All right.
Good on you, thank you. Actually, another one just on the scenes. The scene from Jeddah was filmed at Canangra Walls, south of Blue Mountains, after a reef was destroyed by heat after filming in the desert. There must be so many stories about the locations of where all these films were shot.
In particularly Jeddah. I mean, I'm thinking that my next project, because Chevelle inspired me so much, is that I'll attempt to write a feature script based on his making of Jeddah alone, which would encompass it. Because Jeddah was just improbable. Anyone else would have given up. Some of the locations, I know there was Ormiston Gorge, and I know they filmed most of it at the Coolabah Ranges, but they went all over the Northern Territory. I mean, there's shots of Uluru, Ayers Rock, and Catherine Gorge. But basically, it was the first Australian film to be filmed in colour, And they tried Kodachrome in their tests. Their tests involved driving around the north of Australia doing a 10,000-mile trek getting the stories together.
Because we think about that now, and it's no big deal because we have air-conditioned trucks. There are all sorts of things that production companies have.
51.
Yeah, they're not going to have the sort of gear that they've got now just for comfort for actors.
Well, just briefly, Sue Chevelle Carlson, Chevelle's sole daughter, Charles and Elsa's only daughter, just before she passed away in March last year, she finally finished her book on her father's career, and she tells the story of accompanying them on this 10,000-mile drive, and she said, "Oh, Dad didn't believe in fancy things like tents."
Oh, fancy things like tents.
Yeah,
so what did they have?
Well, they just slept outside.
Crikey.
And there's a great scene in Jeddah where Jeddah herself describes sleeping outside and seeing the stars.
Yeah. Let's go back a little bit and take a look at his childhood. Did he have a childhood surrounded by people who are creative?
Well, his mother, Bella, is supposed to be the, from what I read in Sue's book, was the creative influence. Apparently she could sing and play piano, which I suppose in that era, in the late 19th century, wasn't that unusual, but she was the inspiration. His father, Alan, was reputed to be a strict disciplinarian. They got on very well after he left home and made a success of himself. But Alan was very strict, and the boys, I think Chevelle had four brothers and a sister.
Okay.
I could be wrong with that, but I'm close. But basically, they were a big family growing up on a fairly large farm, fairly large property. And Charles very much took after Bella, his mother, and had an artistic streak. And Alan wanted at least one of his boys to stay on the farm and continue the tradition and the property. And Charles just was drifting away, as all the boys did. They wanted to get away from their father, by the sounds of it.
We mentioned earlier, because I had a question here, that there was a street named after him, and you were saying it could have been his grandfather.
Yeah, his uncle, Harry. His uncle, Harry Chevelle, is a famous name in Australian history for leading the charge on Beersheba of the Australian Light Horse.
Oh, okay.
And and Alan was there. Alan, his father, supplied remounts, a very vital piece of logistics for the horsemen in the desert, of course.
Okay.
And the person that Alan Chevelle worked with was A.B. Banjo Patterson.
Wow.
So he was in the Australian Light Horse. And when we get to talk about 40,000 horsemen, I'll tell you the significance of that.
Max, good morning.
I think you're going to help me more than I'm going to help you. I'm 86 now. When I was a young fella doing my scholarship, I went up to O'Reilly's.
Ah,
and,
yes.
What the name of the film is, I can't remember.
Yes, Sons of Matthew.
Sons of Matthew, that's right. And you mentioned the chap that acted in it too a moment ago.
Yeah, Michael Pate.
That's the fella. And I was a pretty practical kid, and they ripped a sump out of an old utility they were using to take their stuff around. I helped them weld this.
Oh, did you?
The bottom of this sump plate back on. So I went with them everywhere, and they had the toy at the time of their life. I remember, well, vividly, not vividly because of my age, I'm pretty vague, but they had a couple of big aircraft engines that they'd lowered over the side of the mountain at O'Reilly's to create storm effects.
Okay. Well, yeah. You must see my doco. There's a fantastic yarn by Michael Pate about how tough it was to get 30 metres.
How
hard it was. There's this fantastic scene towards the end of Sons of Matthew. The climax was the big cyclone scene. So you actually saw the de Havilland fans. They were injured, plane engine fans.
Yeah, they lowered them over the side of the hill down. Look, I was a kid of 13. I'm 86 now. My memory is a bit shot to bits, but I can remember that the noise and the pumping of water over the side of the
hill. Yeah, right.
While I blew the water over the front of the aircraft.
Yeah, so you actually saw the scene? Did you see Michael Pate?
I was watching them do all this because I was with the crew. I used to ride with the crew because I'd helped them with this bit of a sump. Welded a sump up on any old utility.
The scene in the film, Michael Pate clearly has very detailed recollections of what happened, but basically the strength of those fans, they're aircraft engine fans, and they're simulating a cyclone scene, and he has to battle his way through this undergrowth and bush to get to the water because his beloved Kathy has fallen off her, been thrown off her horse, hit a rock and fallen into the water, and she's going to drown. So he has to dive into this rock pool that they've created there. And Chevelle, for some reason, just went, he did a Stanley Kubrick and made him redo it and redo it and redo it and redo it. And Pate tells the story of trying to battle his way 30 yards, 30 metres, against the force of these fans, against genuine undergrowth and sort of tangled weeds, and fighting his way through.
So it wasn't acting.
No, it wasn't acting. So he had to swim across this, and Kathy really did have Thelma Scott, I think it was. It wasn't Thelma. I can't remember her name, sorry. But basically she did have concussion from falling off the horse.
Serious?
Yeah, serious. And so she's in the middle of this freezing rock pool, and Pate had to save her. And he had some clear advice for the director that was picked up by people who could read lips.
It wasn't nice. Thank you very much, Max. Good morning, Cedric.
I just wanted to tell you, it was back in 1946, Sons of Ashes, part of it was made there at Nubbinbar Valley, and my father was one of the actors in it. He was the mailman.
Oh, right, okay.
How did he get the job, Cedric?
Well, it was made on the farm that we were on at Nubbinbar Valley. We were on a half-share farm down at Nubbinbar Valley.
Do you remember them? Do you remember Charles and Nelson?
Yeah, I remember them well.
Were they all right, Cedric? Were they nice people?
Well, very nice people. And my two older brothers and my father helped them clear the site, had to clear the scrub on the farm at Nubbinbar Valley to build the store and shop, Tongabel store, they called it.
I'm fearing, oh, okay, Cedric, that they weren't actors, but they just sort of said, you look good enough to me, you can be the postman.
Our dad was in it.
Yeah.
He rode the horse down through the street of Dongabel delivering the mail.
Right,
he was a mailman.
Oh, right, okay. So that actually, the Dongabel actually exists, does it?
Beg your pardon?
Does the Dongabel exist?
Yeah, they built the little shop and that day.
Well, on behalf of the Chevelles, they thank the farm people throughout their careers for the help that they got. They couldn't have done it. You know, they were putting Queensland on screen,
yep,
and outback New South Wales on screen for the first time in a lot of cases. And they openly acknowledged that they couldn't have done it without the help of people such as yourself.
Let's go back. Thank you very much, Cedric. Let's go back again and take a look at the first films that he made. When did he start getting interested in film?
Oh, well, it's through Snowy Baker. I mean, he was... I don't know if he watched films as a kid. I don't think they...
There weren't that many around.
No, but when he got involved with Snowy Baker, who was making films, and Snowy realised that he could ride a horse, he was an extra in then, so it would have been there. And then, of course, he ends up in Hollywood making films there. He came back... As I said before, I see Chevelle as a career filmmaker. He learnt from watching films being made in Hollywood, and they were churning out more than 700 a year. Some of those films were made in 2 weeks, huge budgets. And he saw the success of Nanook of the North, which film historians know about. It was a film about an Alaskan tribal person or whatever, and it was a very successful film. And Chevelle realised that regional films could work, and that was his vision for Australia. So when he came back, very fired up, great entrepreneur, he could, you know, he'd sort of create a bathing beauty contest at the drop of a hat and put the word film next to it and get a lot of people in. He'd get a lot of publicity. He was also a prolific writer. In fact, that's how he made a living in Hollywood. He made it writing magazine articles. And he got the money for The Moth of Moonbi from Country Folk.
Because if you're coming from Hollywood, where they've got buckets of money and huge budgets for making film back to Australia with an expectation of making films like that, you're going to find it pretty hard.
Well, yeah, but he knew, and that's what he battled all his life. I mean, he's like any kid that reads a great book and wants to match it and then faces reality of creating it. And that was the thing about film. And he had that vision. And his first film, Moth of Moonbee, which was about tells the story of Dell, a country girl that on an isolated farm and gets a £500 inheritance and goes chasing the bright lights of Brisbane.
<That's> so
in 1926, and she goes back to the farm. So he's showing all the amazing farm scenes with 10,000 head of cattle on properties and drovers fording the river. It was the images of great opulence.
What it does, it makes you resourceful. And from what you're saying, he was a resourceful filmmaker.
And he go to where people weren't. He was the ultimate freelance journalist, actually. He was sort of like he'd always try and get that angle that no one else could get.
Let's then take a look at the important role that Elsa, his wife, played in their story as well. Mm-hmm. Did he meet her, then marry, or what was the story there?
Elsa was born in Collingwood. In Melbourne, but her family soon left to go and spend 20 years in South Africa, and she was an actress, and she was an established stage actress. And Chevelle, by the time he came to his second film, Greenhide, had seen her perform in Brisbane, and wanted her for the lead role, which was quite raunchy. A girl who did the Charleston Night Chocolates and was the life of the party. But
enough of that.
Oh. Yeah, that's right. She was the reverse of Del. She was the city party girl that ended up going to the bush and being carried off by God, some caveman. Cattle duffers.
Okay,
and she was rescued. But by the end of the film, basically, her mother didn't like the idea of Elsa going into this fly-by night business called movies, and she stopped Elsa from going to the first meeting from the appointment, and Chevelle turned up and said, "No, young lady, you know we had an appointment."
Yeah.
And from that moment on, that was it. She went and made the film, and they were engaged by the end of it, and soon married.
How important was she then in the future of the filmmaking as a pair?
She had a very successful she was having a very successful career as an actress. And when they did go to Hollywood in 1928, she got interviews that Chevelle couldn't get. And she was offered a stage lead in a stage play, and that stage play became a film. But by that time, just as they came back to Australia, because Charlie wanted to pursue that, and she would have had a very successful career.
Okay.
But some people think that she sacrificed her own career for her husband. And in subsequent interviews over the years, she didn't regret it one bit. She was co-writer, co-producer. They were very much a very strong team. And they asked a lot of the people they worked with. They didn't go down in history as being popular all the time with the people that they worked with, because they asked, they put themselves through so much and they expected everyone else to follow, and not everyone wanted to.
Yeah. Just because you've got the passion and the drive, and you're prepared to put in 20 hours a day.
Michael Pate told the story about Sons of Matthew that after they ran out of money the first time, he came back and did the other 2.5 years for £25 a week rather than £20 a week.
Were his films successful in Australia?
Well, 40,000 Horsemen changed Australian culture. It was very successful financially. And Jeddah did too. I mean, I don't know about it being successful financially, but it changed. There were attitudes to Aboriginals before Jeddah, and they were different after. 40,000 Horsemen starts off. The opening strains of Lindley Evans' score were Advance Australia Fair, and then after a few bars, that drips into Waltzing Matilda, and so we both know those tunes now, but people didn't then. And in fact, Elsa tells the story of people saying, "What are you playing those old tunes for?" And it's true, and that's just the beginning of it. And many of us, sadly, Chips Rafferty's not a household name anymore, but he should be.
Yeah.
For the roles that he had. And the charge scene's just incredible.
Tell us about the charge scene, because you're saying how important that is.
Well, Chips Rafferty described it as the greatest charge scene in any ever made on film. And the story of it is that the Australian Light Horse were assembled in Sydney for the sesquicentenary in 1938, 150 years of the white settlement of Australia. And Charles knew that this was a one-off chance, so never missing an opportunity, he asked the army if he could borrow these horsemen for a day and shoot this scene. So he got that on the whim of that. He then approached Herc McIntyre, who was head of Universal Studios in Australia, distribution, and painted this big picture about the exploits of the Light Horse in World War One. And Herc says it on film, and it's in my documentary, borrowed from the action director. Herc gave him £5,000, and with that £5,000, which was a lot of money, Charles rolled the dice, and he shot this one scene, the charge scene, on the sand dunes of Cronulla Kurnell in Sydney. So with the four great cameramen that he had, they put it all in one hit.
Geez, you got to have a bit of front too. I mean, it sounds like you had a bit of front.
I ended up thinking that he was sort of like a bit of a toff, and sort of and you know was getting money from the upper crust of the country party, but that wasn't the case at all. He'd just pull any lever he could.
Gabe, good morning.
Yeah, my grandfather, he drove the coach in the Mothamoonbi.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Wow. That's going back.
And then Kim Dwyer, it's in the area of Rosevale.
Oh, okay.
Where they did a bit of the film.
Right.
How much has he dined out on that story, Gabe?
Well, I've seen the Mothamoonbi back in 1984.
Right, okay.
Because we had a centenary there.
Right.
But the Mothamoonbi was only discovered after a fire went through the archives in Brisbane.
Right. Hearing this.
And that's the only reason why I rang up, because, you know, my grandfather was there and Tim Dwyer was the cattle bearer, and a lot of the film was made up in JL, JL Ranch, they used to call it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I wonder if the cattle scenes were filmed there, because there was a lot more cattle than land from what I remember.
Well, see, Henriksen's had a lot of property, and they used to have a lot of cattle.
Mm.
Like, they would be cattle bearers in those days. Mm. And I think that's where their cattle were filmed.
So, Gabe, was he a well-known actor of the time?
Oh, my grandfather?
Yeah.
No, he was just a farmer.
It sounded like he got that Chevelle got an awful lot of time out of local farmers and whoever's in the area at the time.
Yeah, and the woman that you were talking about, the one that he drove the coach for and when she left there to go to Brisbane.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that's great to hear from you. You know, they talk about what they had to do when they were out on the road. You know, basically they took their own chooks and cattle, you know, to sort of make some of these things. And the number of floods that they went through.
Yeah. Vince, good morning.
Good morning. Look, in 40,000 Horsemen, were some of the scenes, I knew most of the bulk of it was made at Cronulla, but were some of the scenes made in the sand hills at Randwick or South Coogee?
No, as far as I know, it was all done at the sand scenes were all shot at Cronulla Kurnell, which doesn't look like that now because they reckon they've taken 70 million tonnes of sand out of there since the film was made.
Jeez.
And they had vast expanses. The film wasn't all shot there, though. There's this plain, which is flat, which apparently resembles the landscape that the actual battle was fought in, the 400 horsemen in near Orange. So as far as I know, the charge scene was filmed in Cronulla Kurnell and also at Orange. It's a fair way away to get your horses.
Thank you very much, Vince. We can't go without talking about Errol Flynn and how he was discovered. How did they find Errol Flynn? Where did that happen?
Well, I think his name was John Warwick. Chevelle's assistant director read this story in a local newspaper about this amazing, heroic sea captain who had his own yacht called the Sirocco, and it was shipwrecked off the coast of New Guinea, and this brave captain saved the girl, swam ashore. And there was a photo of this swarthy captain, and it was Errol Flynn. And John Warwick saw the photo and said, oh, apparently this guy's in Sydney to Chevelle. You should take a look at him. So they met. The story goes, and it's been recounted many times, that Charles Chevelle met Errol Flynn at the Hotel Australia in the bar, the main bar there. And Chevelle basically asked him, he said, oh, have you done any acting? Yeah, he said, nah, but I'll do anything once. And judging by the performance that he gave in that, he nearly...
It could have only been once.
It could have only been once. I think the floorboards that they painted on the canvas set in the studios there were less wooden than his performance.
Nick, good morning.
Good morning, Trevor. I've been listening to all the stories about 40,000 Horsemen and Sons of Matthew, but I haven't heard anybody mention yet the fact that one of Australia's greatest welterweight fighters, fought under the name of Tommy Burns,
yes,
his real name
right.
was Geoffrey Murphy,
yep.
was a bit actor in the Sons of Matthew.
Yeah,
and I just wonder how Chevelle chose him for the role of one of the Sons of Matthew.
Well, there was a lot of publicity. He would make... get a lot of publicity out of small acts, and that was one of them. They staged this elaborate fight scene, which apparently got a bit carried away at the time. And yes, that's true. There's fantastic photos of that fight scene, and they weren't mucking around in the impact of the punches and stuff. And yes, it's remiss of me not to mention, but there's so many of those sort of anecdotes and stories, and it is a great fight scene. Michael Payton made special mention of that particular fight. That and the what they did to the trees and the rainforests up there, and all the axemen had to learn the real thing from chopping down those 1,000-year-old trees.
It sounds like, Nick, thank you for calling. It sounds like one of the things from his films that because he's using people that weren't necessarily actors but were part of whatever it was that they were doing, that's where he got a lot of the authenticity in his film.
Yeah. Yep.
Let's talk a little bit about your documentary and the research. What are the things that you've found that interested you doing the research about Charles Chevelle?
Well, you know, I'm very much... I've become a video journalist, I've been a print journalist, and I now work with images, and I'm the beneficiary of the new technology. Like, my stills camera, which I've got in the studio here, is now my movie camera, and I'm getting the best images I've ever had out of something of that size and lenses that are there. We can now make feature films, and a lot of us are, you know, that are getting out there. If you storytellers want to get out there, you can get the cameras with the technology. The whole paradigm shifted. You can, every man, woman and child on the planet can have their own broadcast station through things like Ustream. You know, it's a world of instantaneous communication, and whatever level you like, doesn't necessarily mean that anyone will want to watch what
you've
done.
No, you can make it.
But Chevelle had the same attitude. He was incredibly determined, and I really hope that gets across. And if his career is revived through the re-release of his films, I hope he gains his place in the Australian psyche again that he deserves. Because, as I said, you know, we hear Advance Australia Fair every day, we wouldn't have. Waltzing Matilda wasn't a standard before his films. Those actors, you know, like we said, we know Errol Flynn, Peter Finch in particular. I think his performances that I've seen, I think he's the best actor that we've produced, besides Cate Blanchett's recent Blue Jasmine performance.
Yeah.
Before we do leave, I'd like to mention that the reason this documentary has been made is that all his films have been restored, and they're being distributed, in June. I think
that'll
all be re-released. And that I was commissioned by Umbrella Entertainment to distribute DVDs, and it's a great investment by Jeff Harrison, who's got a passion for Australian film, and that's why this story's been told. And also Sue Chevelle Carlson, who sadly passed away this time last year. It was she wrapped up her life's work. One of the final deals she did was to make sure that films were going to be restored and get out there again. And her father's work was her passion for life. And her book's fantastic. It hasn't got a publisher yet, but it should have, and that was the basis of the research.
So it'd be terrific for film historians and a love of Australian film and to be able to see those.
I think just, you know, I hope that Australian film lovers watch it. I hope it gets rerun on Sunday afternoons on Channel 9 or whatever it is. Or it should be on the ABC instead of those sort of Z-grade pommy films that we see.
See some Australian.
Yeah.
John, thank you very much for joining us. John Doggett-Williams, journalist, documentary maker and producer of The Big Picture, the films of Charles...